I just can't emphasize enough how important it is for us to be checking in on our neighbors and looking out for our friends. With temperatures below freezing in the coming days, our neighbors experiencing homelessness in particular need a warm space to go.
And that's Mayor Jenny Durkin talking about the cold snap in our weather and helping neighbors, particularly those who are homeless, to get inside. Now, we have two goals today on the show, people: stay warmed and stay informed. Welcome to Seattle News, Views, and Brews, your coffee break political podcast. I'm Brian Callanan. I'm a host on Seattle Channel, and the views expressed here are my own. And joining me is the always warm and sometimes fuzzy Kevin Schofield, depending on the last time he shaved. Kevin Schofield of Seattle City Council Insight. Hello to you, sir.
Hey, and the views I express are Frosty the Snowman's.
Ah, love it, love it. All right. Our thanks to City Grind Espresso, our background noise sponsor for the audio podcast. They're on the first floor of City Hall. They're closed during the pandemic, but they're still rocking their location at the Henry Art Gallery. Please support them and other small businesses, too. I am happy to announce that Jackson has joined us as a patron of the show this week at the $10 level. Thank you so much, Jackson. I have sent him his very own Seattle News, Views, and Brews coffee mug. And Kevin, you got yours going on? Nice, beautiful. Good to see. And I wanted to point out that there are a number of other people that have sent these things in. Our patrons are sending in mug shots, some great photos coming in here. Sergey with a cool looking setup there and some Primo coffee brewing there too. Rob giving us the extreme close up. Thank you to both of you for this. I can almost smell that coffee from here, Rob. Nice work. And if you want to join in on the fun, please become a patron of the show on Patreon at the $10 level or whatever you can give. We're going to reward all of our longtime patrons with a mug, too, at some point here. So please do help us on Patreon and support local journalism. And thank you also to Converge Media. Converge runs the video version of our podcast on their YouTube channel Wednesday nights at 6. Off we go with Right Here, Right Now. So here we are, middle of February, coming out of the President's Day weekend. The Seattle City Council's got a resolution supporting the state's work on big business taxes. There's also an ordinance updating the fire code related to construction. But I want to start, Kevin, with a discussion the city has been having over the last several days here, going into emergency mode to deal with the cold weather that we've been having. I was struck last week at the mayor's press conference that when it comes to cold weather emergency shelters for homeless people, the city's been able to stand up 78 COVID-compliant spaces at Fisher Pavilion with help from the Salvation Army there. There's a few others dotted around the city when it comes to community centers, too. And I guess looking at this, having unsheltered people in any weather is a major issue for Seattle. But when you throw this cold snap in, it really throws it into focus. We're talking about hundreds of spots that might be available within the city of Seattle, but then 3,700 people, according to the last count of the homeless, that are unsheltered. And talk to me about this, Kevin, your thoughts.
Yeah, it's a problem. And it's particularly a problem right now with COVID because you can't have, you know, just rows and rows of mats on the floor.
Yeah.
Right? That is unhealthy in COVID, and we don't want to create super spreader events by doing
right.
that. So the city is kind of stuck, and they've over the past year have had to decompress a lot of their, you know, traditional shelter spaces and close some of the, you know, the basic shelter spaces just because it couldn't create the kind of separation you need between individuals.
Yeah, de-intensify, right.
Yeah, what they call and that's what they've done for other ones. They've decompressed or de-intensified other ones, which overall reduced the capacity. Now, they've tried to stand up other ones. There's a new Salvation Army shelter that's just opening up right now, which is great. And so the city right now is doing cold weather shelters.
Yeah.
It's interesting. There was a debate a few weeks back about whether the city should close. It's been doing a basic shelter overnight in City Hall.
Right, right.
For, you know, quite a while now.
Yes.
And they've recently closed that. One of the reasons they closed it is because they said, we might need that for exactly this case of what's going on, you know, right now, the cold weather, extreme weather shelter space. So,
yes.
You know, that may be a space that if necessary, they end up opening up as well.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, they would, you know, tend to use the Seattle Center Arena.
Yeah. Right.
Too, which,
right.
of course, is, you know, a major construction site at the moment.
Yeah. But, no kidding. I guess this whole idea with COVID and how it works with this homelessness issue, it really seems to me, Kevin, that COVID has kind of changed the discussion when it comes to sheltering homeless people, and maybe permanently here, because I just wonder if this whole concept of having congregate shelters is going to go away. What do you think about that long term?
It's an interesting question. And one of the
because certainly people aren't eager to go into congregate shelters. I think we've established that.
No. And they weren't before either.
Yeah, right.
Which is why, you know, we moved from, you know, basic shelters, mountain floors, to enhanced shelters, to, you know, things like the Navigation Center, to tiny home villages, right, where people actually have a locked door. And they can, you know, they can store their own belongings with them.
They so they don't get stolen, which is a big problem for homeless people.
Which is a big part. So, you know, and now, you know, one of the big trends is hoteling. Mm-hmm. But the problem is a lot of these are really expensive. Hoteling is very expensive. Mm-hmm. And the question, the longer term question is, which is more expensive? Mm. Even, you know, any emergency shelter approaches, including hoteling, or actually creating more affordable housing.
Right. And you got to have the real estate for it, too.
Are we doing the short-term emergency thing that's super, super expensive?
Yes.
Or are we really fixing the long-term problem by creating more affordable housing, which is also super, super expensive?
I think you got to do both. And I think the city's trying to engage that right now.
You have to do both.
Yeah.
But in what balance?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
In that's what always... balance do you try to sort of say, we'll do this much of this one and this much of that one?
Yeah. Yeah. That's going to be the challenge ahead here. Kevin, I want to switch gears with you and talk about the work going on behind the scenes right now regarding King County Equity Now and the Black Brilliance Research Project. So this really came to a head last week, a $3 million contract the city awarded to King County Equity Now to determine where $30 million in participatory budgeting funds would go. You raised some red flags about this, Kevin, about the way the city council set up this contract back in December on Seattle City Council Insight. And please do take this the right way. I am not happy to report that you were right about what was going on there.
I'm not happy for you to report that I'm right. Really, really wanted to be wrong about this one, right? Because there is a lot more we need to learn about what really does create community safety in the Black community and immigrant communities in the city and in, you know, the communities that really just have not gotten enough attention and not gotten enough love and who traditionally have been over-policed, at least over-policed. You know, they're, you know, what you hear from, what I certainly hear from talking to people in the community is that the police tend to over-police small crimes and under-police significant larger crimes, right?
Yep.
Which is a pretty toxic combination.
Yeah, right, right.
So understanding, you know, what are the things we can do farther upstream that will really create safety and keep people off the streets and stop kids from getting involved in gangs and all, you know, and create more just economic security for these underserved communities is really important things that we need to learn a lot more about. Right. Yeah. And my hope was that, you know, even if there are problems with this contract, we would learn a lot. And we learned some things from it, but you know, $3 million is a really, really large research contract.
Yeah.
And Freedom Project, the fiscal agent for King County Equity Now on this, is an organization that their biggest annual budget prior to this was $250,000.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, this is 12 times larger than the biggest thing they've ever dealt with.
And there's
been a bunch of issues. But what's happened right now is
I jumped ahead a little bit here, but we're talking about now a split.
So King County Equity Now contracted with a bunch of researchers to do a lot of the on-the-ground research. Mm-hmm. It was not terribly well organized.
Right.
There have been, for several weeks now, you know, rumors going around that some of the researchers aren't getting paid, that the researchers who are getting paid who aren't doing any work. And there's been just major tensions between this group of researchers and King County Equity Now. And that just came to a head last week where the researchers basically banded together and said, we're cutting off our ties in King County Equity Now.
This had some problems with the leadership of KCEN. Yeah.
Now, it's not clear how this is going to play out because there's contractual agreements here, right? Freedom Project is the contracted fiscal agent for this project.
Right.
And they have a contract with King County Equity Now to go sort of manage the research while Freedom Project handles basically the paperwork.
And Freedom Project is a subcontractor. I know that Freedom Project is a little complicated here too,
which is potentially a conflict of interest. And the state auditor is looking at that and potentially other issues with this.
Yeah.
So, you know, eventually the state auditor is going to, you know, produce a report on this. And I'm a little scared as to what they're going to find about how bad things really were behind the scenes on this.
Yeah.
In the meantime, you know, King County Equity Now is supposed to be delivering a final report on this research project on February 26th.
That's right.
It's not clear whether that's going to happen because their researchers have been doing this work aren't really playing ball with them anymore.
Right.
The researchers are saying, we're working with Freedom Project directly now.
Yeah.
This. But that's they actually don't get to do that mm-hmm. under the contracts that are in place.
Yeah.
Right. It all has to go through King County Equity now.
Right.
So it's a huge mess. Yeah. You know, I had a quick email exchange with Councilmember Morales
yes.
and Enterprise folks
yeah.
last week. She said, you know, I wasn't aware of all the stuff
right.
that was going on, which I find hard to believe because, you know, this has been one of the worst kept secrets in the city that there were issues with this contract.
Sure.
And I've heard many reports that Councilmember Morales has been running around behind the scenes trying to clean up a lot of these messes.
Yeah. So
she knew there were messes here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But at this point, she's saying, I'm still looking into it, trying to figure out what's going on and what the next
right.
steps are.
When I think this whole process strikes a blow against this very important job of figuring out, as you say, what works for different communities of color in terms of policing, whatever else. But it also really, to me, strikes at the heart of what is participatory budgeting all about? Because I remember these very careful conversations during the budget sessions last year, the council setting aside this $30 million for their process with participatory budgeting, and then $30 million set aside for the mayor's Equitable Communities Initiative. I just wondered, does the mayor's initiative now gain some more public support, or what's going to be the upshot of all this?
Yeah, what I'm hearing behind the scenes is King County Equity now really wants to talk to the mayor's task force.
Sure.
And see if they can sort of combine forces in some ways on this.
So a task force that has not been all that transparent up to now.
It has not been transparent.
Yeah.
Their meetings aren't open. They're doing a little better job now of publishing the minutes after the fact, mm-hmm. but they're still not particularly transparent. But to me, it really comes back to this issue of, if we want to understand what's going on in these communities, what's mm-hmm. really going to help them,
yeah.
how much do we need cultural competence in doing that?
Yep.
Right, the city could have contracted with UW or a number
sure.
of different
yep.
research organizations to go do a study of these communities, mm-hmm. right? But you know, if you bring in a bunch of upper middle class white people
yep.
to study one of these communities, are you really going to find out what's going on?
Yep.
Or do you
right.
need people inside of these communities
mm-hmm.
to be active participants
yep.
and sort of leaders
yep.
in doing this research? They make sure you talk to the right people.
Yeah.
And you really get to the heart of where the issues are, what the problems are, and what the solutions could look like.
Right? Yeah.
And there's a very strong case to be made that you have to go do that.
Yeah. I think the council certainly did.
And I think that's what the council in King County Equity
yeah.
now we're trying to do with it.
Yeah.
But the challenge is, you know, after generations of underinvesting in these communities,
yeah.
it's not clear that we've lifted up, you know, to the point of sort of research rigor and competence people in these communities who can really do that work. And that's not on them.
Right.
That's on us.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. yeah
so,
yeah.
so
the support,
you know,
not being there. Yeah.
We've created this problem, right? Where, where we really need the cultural competence to be able to get the right information and the people who can help us really get that cultural competence, you know, in a rigorous way are super hard to find.
Yeah, this has been a difficult, difficult conversation to have about this at the city level here. And I know we're going to keep on talking about what's happening with our police department in our next segment here. Now hear this. All right, here's a question for you. Is the city council going to cut another $5.4 million from the Seattle Police Department budget? Here's an answer. Maybe. City Council Member Lisa Herbold, chair of the Public Safety Committee, spoke last week about this. She says the council is going to check in with the federal monitor and the Department of Justice overseeing the consent decree facing the SPD before they make that call. Let's listen.
The city recognizes that additional major reductions to SPD staffing could threaten to undermine consent decree reforms in areas such as supervision, training, and use of force reporting, investigation, and review. The city will work with the monitor and the DOJ to prevent that outcome.
Kevin, this harkens back to the story we discussed last week where Judge Robart, overseeing the consent decree, had some harsh words for the council about their defund the police efforts. It seems like the council is responding to those criticisms. How do you look at this?
Yeah, he chewed them out.
Yeah.
He really chewed them out and on really two fronts. One is around the whole crowd control weapons, but also around, you know, their rush to commit to defunding the police by 50% last summer and then having to back away from that. And, you know, he said, look, you know, if you go forward and make cuts to the police without a plan for specifically how you're going to provide essential services to
yeah,
the city
functions. Mm-hmm.
that the police are doing right now,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to jump in and stop you again
yeah.
from doing this. And
right.
I think in that specifically, that warning is what Councilmember Herbold is reacting to now and saying, okay, I hear the judge, and this is sort of the same thing. They in that same meeting, the council member and her colleagues were struggling with around their draft bill for crowd control,
which we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah. This notion of the judge saying, you know, here are the limits, and the city council, while wanting to be really aggressive in a couple of areas, balancing it out with saying we can be really aggressive and we will get nothing.
Or we
can back off a few steps,
follow
the right processes, be a little more moderate in our approach to this, and get something.
Right. Can we break down what this $5.4 million is all about first, though? I want to touch on this before we do crowd control here. I know the council's been trying to rein in overtime pay at the SPD for many years. This has been going on for a while. This is part of that effort. And this really did start last year during the summer budget rebalancing process. The SPD was responding to these protests with a lot of officers, a lot of overtime, and they had basically already overspent their budget when that rebalancing was approved. And then on top of that, in the fall, the SPD had increased costs with separation pay, a lot of different officers leaving, more parental leave too, some other overtime needs. So the SPD said, we need this $5.4 million after the fall budget process was done. The council at the time approved that extra money, but now in 2021, they're saying we're going to take that money back? Or how do you look at this, Kevin?
Yeah, so both the mayor and the council screwed up a little bit last summer when they were doing the rebalancing package. And it just took a long time, and they were trying to do it fast. And you know, they did it at the same time all these protests were going on, and SPD was racking up a lot of overtime costs really quickly. And you know, there's a genuine criticism you can make of SPD that they were over policing these protests, right? Which caused their overtime costs to be higher than probably they should have been. And at the time when the council and a lot of other folks were saying, hey, sending so many police officers to every protest is actually escalating things.
Yeah,
it's not de-escalating things. You're making things worse by doing this. Mm-hmm. So there's that whole part of it.
Yeah.
But as everybody was moving fast, you know, from the time at the end of June that the mayor said, okay, I'm going to cut the overtime budget from $29 million down to $21 million, and the council finally got that approved on August 10th at $21 million or $21.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
By the time it got to August 10th, SPD had already spent more than $21.2 million on overtime, right? So they were destined to be over. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the city council passed a resolution that said, we will not approve additional end-of-year requests for more money to cover overtime, budget overruns.
Mm-hmm.
But they were already set up to do that, right?
Yep.
So, and by the way, you know, when they cut back, you know, staffing and all these other things, they cut back basically all the other buckets of money that SPD could have gone to.
That's
to
right.
Say, okay, we'll cover that overrun from this
with
other
this.
Bucket.
Yeah.
Which, you know, pretty much every department does with some things that go over and some things that go under.
Yeah.
And so they didn't really have a lot of ability to do that. So it got to the end of the year. They were over on overtime. They covered, you know, four of their 5 million kind of overrun on overtime with you know, money from other buckets. And they said there's about $1 million that we spent on things related to COVID.
Sure, right. Staffing, you know, some of the different testing sites, et cetera.
And, and more PPE and equipment for officers and things like that. And by the way, FEMA lets us reimburse that.
Yes,
so,
right.
Of the big FEMA reimbursement check that we got, can we spend $1 million of it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we've got the separation pay issue, since they had more separations. And when officers leave, if they've got accrued vacation and leave, then they get basically a check for that,
as opposed,
because they can't use that vacation anymore, but they've got accrued, they're owed it.
Sure.
So, and because there was higher attrition in the fall, that was a lot more money.
That's the separation pay.
There's also more parental leave.
Yep.
There's a central bucket of money that the city uses to basically cover when there's overruns in different places.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the city said, can we transfer some money from that to cover SPD's excess parental leave?
Yeah.
And what the city council came back with was, hey, if you hadn't covered your overtime overrun with these other buckets, you would have had enough money to cover all this other stuff.
Sure.
So no, we're not going to do that. Since, since it's the end of the year, we're going to pay the $5.4 million now.
Yeah.
Right. but we're going to take it out of your budget for next year.
Yeah.
So that's what this bill sitting in front of the city council is right now.
Yeah.
It's basically to offset the extra $5.4 million they spent last year.
Yeah.
And the city council says we're going to take that $5.4 million and we're going to add it to the $30 million in the participatory budgeting process.
Sure, sure. Yeah, just jumping in here, Kevin, I wanted to make sure that I put across the point that, and I think the council members were making this point too, they are trying as best they can to respond to a lot of people in our community who are saying, you know, this money that's extra money for overtime or whatever else that has been going to police, that needs to be drawn into community solutions there. I think that's just to try to get an idea of the council's logic behind this, if you want.
Yeah, that's a part of it. Another part is, you know, it is political suicide in Seattle right now to add more money to SPD's budget
for
anything.
Yeah.
Right. You know, there's enormous political pressure to cut it even further.
Sure.
Right.
Right.
They're resisting that just to leave it sort of at the point it's in right now. And quite frankly, the city council members wanted to cut it a lot more too.
Sure.
So they're in response to the DOJ and police monitor and the, and Judge Robart, they're kind of leaving in place till they can get a better plan in place.
Yeah.
But they definitely don't want to add $5.4 million because they're going to come under enormous heat.
And I guess just to follow up on that idea about constituent pressure, let's move back to that whole idea about a crowd control ordinance. The city doesn't have anything on the books about this right now. They're hoping to get something on there. But I think at the same time, they've realized that they've hit a wall a little bit with the Department of Justice here, and they're going to wait a little bit. This whole idea of submitting this draft bill to the judge in this case here, is how do you look at that step, what the city did here?
So in doing their sort of last-minute amendments to this bill,
they
kind of moderated a couple of places, looking to just make it, you know, a little more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really trying to cross their T's and dot their I's and make sure they procedurally don't get on the wrong side of Judge Robart again.
Yes, right.
So there's that part. You know, my guess is they expect to get some pushback from the DOJ and the police monitor on this. And then, you know, we'll see what they say. The SPD, just at the end of last week, submitted to the court.
Yes.
After getting approval from the DOJ and the police monitor, their proposed changes to those same policies, to the crowd control policy and the use of force policy. They said, you know, DOJ, police monitor have blessed this. The, you know, and it was based, their you know, their proposed changes were based on a lot of feedback they got from the OPA and the Inspector General. And to some extent, the CPC, though, the CPC had kind of a more extreme view and incorporated some and didn't incorporate other parts of it.
Okay,
so,
right.
So that, you know, that's, and I'm sure they'll get some, you know, some blowback from that.
Yeah.
For many of things in their proposal, there's a lot of consensus, and you know, and they really position it as it's a step. We've got a lot more conversations, a lot more pieces, but and they're supposed to be reviewing and revising those policies annually,
right?
So you know, they finish this, and in a few months they'll start on the next round for next year, where they can bring all that stuff back up again, and maybe take the next step with it.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of steps ahead. This federal consent decree process is still with us after, 8 years and counting here. And so we've got a lot still ahead.
We've got 2+ years to go.
Yeah.
Because even if tomorrow they were to magically get the judge to say, okay, you're back in compliance.
Yeah.
And they're not even close to doing that.
Yeah. There's that probationary period.
They have to sustain it for 2 years.
Yeah.
Right? So we've got, you know, probably 3, maybe more years to go of the consent decree before it goes away.
Wow. We're going to move to our next segment right now. What's next? Kevin, a few things to look ahead to. We're keeping tabs on the grocery stores pushing back on the hazard pay ordinance the city council put into law. A preliminary injunction filed here, and you had a chance to look at some of these court documents. What did you see?
Yeah. So the grocery stores, you know, filed the complaint, you know, a week or two ago about
$4 hazard
pay. And, you know, it looked pretty weak at first. They've now officially filed their, you know, motion for a preliminary injunction, which, you know, will take, you know, a couple of weeks to kind of work through. You know, it was actually a little stronger than I thought it was going to be. I thought initially their argument was pretty weak. They're, you know, they, some to get a preliminary injunction, they have to show that they're likely to win on the merits.
Yeah.
They have to show that there's irreparable harm, which is really going to be a hard one for them.
Yeah.
And what they showed with some of the affidavits they included was just the math doesn't work out for a lot of grocery stores.
Yeah.
They specifically,
it's a store by store thing with these.
For a lot of these, it really is. And so for, two stores in, fairly low income areas, Madrona and Lake City.
Yeah.
You know, they got affidavits from the owners of the grocery outlets in those two stores. And the Madrona one, the owner said that this new hazard pay is going to cost them $20,000 a month. And they did the math for, here's the number of, employees we have and hours, per employee.
Yeah.
And they don't make $20,000 a month on that.
Right.
Store, right. Right. The Lake City one, they said it's going to cost them $10,000 a month, and they don't make $10,000 a month.
Wow.
So, so, this will put them in the red.
Yeah.
And so they, and that's part of how they were arguing for irreparable harm, right?
Right, right.
That if these stores aren't profitable, then they're either going to have to really raise prices
right.
or they're going to have to potentially shut them down.
Wow, that it's just amazing to see how slim that margin is. And I didn't really realize that until you started talking about
it. And that is very much true for grocery industry. It's not true for all retail, but it's very much true for grocery. And even if you look at Amazon's sort of grocery and overall retail business,
it is
not a huge margin.
Right.
It is even this year where, there's lots of memes out there saying massive profits for retail companies this year.
Yes.
There are a couple that are doing really well.
Yeah.
But a lot of the one, particularly grocery stores, there's still so much competition out there, and the margins are just, they've always been thin for grocery, and they continue to be thin for grocery. Right?
Yeah.
And none of this means that, grocery frontline workers don't deserve hazard pay.
Yeah, sure.
But as we talked about before, why is it $4 an hour?
Yeah.
Why is it not $2 or $6? I mean,
they have not sorted that one out at all.
Some thought as to where this number comes from.
Right? Yeah.
And maybe it's not the same in all places.
Right, right. Got to be cognizant of that. Well, Kevin, we need to turn our attention to the important matter of warm baked goods on a cold day. And may I bring your attention to the humble chocolate chip cookie. Only a half of one is actually left in my house right now because we just go through them so quickly. And we went with the thick version here. This is my daughter who makes these. I have found that, and I don't know what about, you're always big on the combination of tastes, green tea plus chocolate chip cookie, off the charts. I love
it. That's great.
I could.
Lavender and chocolate chip cookies is really awesome.
Okay.
One of the things I like to do is substitute in some wheat flour, whole wheat flour, instead of some of the white flour.
Yeah,
it makes it a little chewier, but also unlike white flour, wheat flour actually has some taste to it.
So I'm good with chewy.
Kind of makes it a little more flavorful too. So that's one of the things that I tend to do with when I make chocolate chip cookies. Green tea is awesome because it's not kind of this overwhelming flavor.
Yes.
Lavender, same thing. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, it adds a little more complexity without sort of becoming
the
thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Love it. Yeah. Love it.
But of course, there's I love Mexican, chocolate cookies.
Yes.
Chocolate chip cookies where, they throw a lot of spices in there. And that can be super, super awesome, right? A good spicy chocolate chip cookie. It can be just a lot of fun.
Qué bueno. I love it. I love it, Kevin. Thank you so much for the nice tip on the cookies. I'll have to get my daughter to do that. And cheers to you, my friend. Let's hold up those Seattle News Views and Brews mugs. And I just wanted to tell you, if you want in on these, they're really cool. And we've been shipping them out to a whole bunch of people. Get in with us on Patreon at the $10 a month level to get your very own Seattle News Views and Brews coffee mug. Kevin, thank you so much for checking in, my man.
Thank you, sir.
All right. And thanks, everybody, for checking in to Seattle News, Views, and Brews, where you can always find out what's brewing in local politics. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you listen. And please do support us on Patreon if you like what you're hearing. We need and appreciate your help. Thank you for listening, and thank you for watching on Converge Media 2. We'll see you next time. Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2021.